Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How do I sound now? Sound okay?
Would you ask Pop that question?
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. Monday through on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Okay, here we go.
And it is a summertime edition of Hoops Adjacent on the Athletic NBA Show. David Aldridge is hot ass DC. We're in mourning as we tape this because the Nats have traded another, well, they've traded the best young player since Ted Williams as we speak. For a whole bunch of magic beans, and everything's going to be great in 5 years, blah, 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 blah. In the Bay, with a team that's just the farm system for everybody else.
Don't even get me started. I remember when we got Frankie Montas.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, all right, here you go. Well, Frankie Montas is gone. And guess where he's going?
Did they even tell guys to buy in Oakland when they get there? Or they just have like a hotel? They just
you
rotate
know what
it through.
They all just like, hey man, go stay by the lake. You're gonna be here a couple of years. That's the nicest part.
Damn. Well,
especially now that your general manager over there, Billy Beane, he trade you 2 years in advance.
Right?
Yeah, right? Yeah,
right?
He cast
all right. So we are ostensibly going to talk about the incredible columns that my colleagues have written. Howard Bryant from ESPN is joining us this week on Hoops Adjacent. I'm so delighted he could join us because Howard is my writing idol. He is...
Me too.
Yes. Come on, yes. Now. No, he's my writing idol. He has the writing life I wish I had, Marcus.
Listen,
you know what I'm saying?
I used to go to my neighbor's house when I was a youngster, and I wrote for the high school paper, right? The Tech Scribe, but just mostly to write about myself. But I ain't know nothing about journalism at all until I started writing for the high school paper. But my neighbor will always have a Howard Bryant piece on the fridge.
Oh yeah,
like to like you know mostly like hey you a writer here go another black writer
right
so
right that,
and it was like it would be like Howard Bryant or Ralph Wiley
yes
or,
of course,
of
course.
Jeffrey remember when
Jeff
was
Chihita?
At the Chronicle yeah so
yeah yeah
all these Chihita's little black boy. Inspirations
yeah.
Right? Yeah that's how I got going
well
right?
We love that when I remember when. I think I was the last hire at the old Trib for Bob Maynard before he sold the paper to A&G.
Is that right?
1991.
Really? Yes. Oh,
I was
wow.
the last hire.
That's incredible.
And I remember that right before we left and Bob Maynard, we're all in the room and he's telling us he's got cancer. Mm. And he's telling us that, you know, and everybody's all sour and we're down. Everybody's just down because of what he's, you know, what he's saying. And I remember somebody said, you know, what's the next step? And all he said was to get well. And that's how we all knew that it was real bad.
Yeah.
And when we got sold and we all got fired and had to reapply to Alameda News Group, I remember Bob Valley, the sports editor, came over and he said, listen, you know, this is going to be it for us, but I want you to consider yourself to be in the line of Ralph Wiley and Monty Poole and the guys, you know, that made this sports page really proud. And I was like, Wiley, you know, but yeah, it was just bro. Such an honor to be part of that. And I know, Marcus, you feel this because you live it, you know, to oh, be. Yeah. I mean, Oakland's a special, special place. And to even be in that Trib Tower, man, you just felt like there were some big shoes that you had to follow in.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. What an incredible story.
Wiley, man. Wiley was the absolute best. That's pressure, Howard.
No.
I know, would just.
That's some,
I would just
pressure.
I would
and
just
I remember when I met Ralph.
Yeah.
I first met Ralph at back when they, do you remember when they used to do the, I forgot the name of it, but they used to do like this award show every year. It was not an award show, it was an award, a night, and they were honoring Kurt Flood. Mm-hmm. And Wiley was there, and it was the first time I'd met him. And he was immediately talking about Bob Valley. And I told him what Valley had said, and he said, yeah, Valley, he was the first and only editor that I had who didn't care about the paint job.
Hmm.
You know, let that? You go out and do your job and do what you right. felt, you know. And here's the man who invented the term Billy Ball. And it just was, right. once again, just to be part of that is always just, it's too much.
What you lived up to it, you live up to it with your incredible writing. Howard's new book is on Ricky Henderson. It's phenomenal, as everything else. If you want to read, I mean, I go back, there's very few books I go back and read a second and third time, but I have read Juice in the Game so many times, I can't even, you know, remember how many times I've read it. Because there's some people who write and they write well, but there's some people who write impactfully and importantly, and Howard writes importantly. And your new book, as I say, Ricky, The Life and Legend of an American Original, is out now. Go buy it. It's fantastic. But you've been such a great writer for so long. And I'm so glad we could get you today, because I'm not blowing smoke to either you or to Marcus. I was so thrilled to read what you both wrote about Bill Russell. And I'll throw Vinnie Goodwell from Yahoo in there as well, because I couldn't find it this time. I don't know why. I could not find the words. The words usually always come to me. And I think it was partly because I didn't know how I could possibly make Bill Russell's life more meaningful in death and in my words than it was as he lived it, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't live up to the man. I just couldn't do it. And I felt bad about it. And then I read what you wrote and what Marcus wrote and what Vinny wrote. And I was so happy that there were people who could rise to the occasion and do it well. And you just wrote a beautiful column on ESPN.com. And people know I ain't really trying to give ESPN a whole lot of attention. But in this case, you have to, because it's too good. It's too good for you not to read.
The most sophisticated philosophy was Popeye. I am what I am. To your satisfaction, not to anybody else's. To yours. Just do the best you can.
I want to talk to you both just about how you sat there at the laptop and the stuff started coming out. Like, how did that happen? How did you get it to flow in a way that made sense to you?
Go ahead, Howard. I want to hear yours.
No, I'm batting second. Bomani sent you to call him out as well, so I want to.
He's batting behind Juan Soto.
Well, so to be fair, I think I'm not close, so it was easier, if that what I mean, right? Like I didn't experience Bill Russell. Like I never met him, so it was kind of easy, but I've always had this in the back of my mind. I actually had a couple of years ago, then the pandemic hit, I was trying to figure out how we could get a statue of Bill Russell, because I live in West Oakland and it's critically changing and the people who move here have no idea where they've moved, right? And so I want a monument right here. So it'd be like, right? Yeah, you, all this tech money here, don't forget where you are. You know what I'm saying? Like this was that spot. So, you know, it's more of like a history lesson for me. But the part that always stood out to me about like Bill Russell and Huey Newton is how none of these people are from here. And Howard, you wrote about this in Ricky, the migration that happened from the South to here, Oakland was one of those hubs, right, where people flocked to. And all of the culture, all of like the enrichment, all of the history and the people and just the vibe that makes this place special. It's because of that migration that happened, right? Mm-hmm. And we grew up you hearing about it. Like the reason like Ricky's this book like is so personal to me, because I grew up lying about Ricky Henderson being my cousin. This was the past. You know what I'm saying? You was related to Russell, Hammer, Too Short, or Ricky. Like or Gary Payton, right? You have to somehow say you was related. So I'm like, yeah, Ricky Henderson's my cousin. No, yeah, it's he, you know, all this and that. But you the OGs always told you about, you couldn't have this hoop conversation, especially we came up with Jordan, right? You couldn't have this hoop conversation with some old head telling you about Bill Russell. He from a climber's high, right? So the part where it becomes real to me is how they created something that I benefited from, right? Like their kind of the culture that they created from the Harlem of the West, right, on down to the hip hop. Like the hip hop era of gangster rap, all of that starts from this infusion of black people here. You know what I'm saying? So to me, that was the only way it was tangible to me. Because otherwise, he's just a story of a great man. You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to write it if I felt like y'all felt. Because to me, how do you encapsulate that? So I had a very finite window to explain Bill Russell. Like, hey, he represents this whole movement that happened that Isabel Wilkerson wrote about that has impacted so many neighborhoods and so many communities. Like, we owe it to them. You always hear about that talk about the greatest generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could make a good case that our greatest generation was those people who yo, we're done with Jim Crow. We're out of here. we don't even know where we're going. We don't know what's waiting for us, but we out. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And because of that, Chicago and New York and LA, and you know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that's the cool part. And when you list like the great people of that era, like Bill Russell is top tier.
Yeah. Right? I think that for me, what I found, and I love all of that. And that is the thing. We talk about the Great Migration and we talk about how it changed Chicago and how it changed Detroit and how it changed Philly and these places. And obviously Los Angeles as well. We never tie it to sports.
Yeah.
We never mention it when it comes to sports. We talk about, oh man, look at how LA's got Eric Davis and Eddie Murray and those brothers. And how come, and look at the way these different cities have. And when you talk about Oakland, it's all Frank and Veda and Kurt Flood and Russell. But we talk about them as if they were born there. And some of the guys were, but they don't come from there. Yeah. And so to me, what I found fascinating about it was the creation of Black Oakland is the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. Everything that we talk about now came from that. And when it comes to Russell, for me, this is all, in so many ways, what we do is autobiographical. Why do we write the things we write? Because they touch us personally. Even if we're not putting ourselves in the center, we're talking about something about you protecting your time, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, you grow up in Boston, the specter of Bill Russell is everywhere. The specter of Bill Russell is on you when you grow up in the 70s and in the 80s like I did, because the Celtics were so dominant. Everybody else lost back then. Nobody won. I mean, the Bruins won 2 in 70 and 72. The Red Sox never won. The Patriots were the Patriots. And so all you had was the Celtics. And for me, in the mid-70s, you know, I was a, you know, JoJo White, Charlie Scott, Havlicek, that team. Mm-hmm. But that team was, you know, Paul Silas, another McClyman's High guy. Yeah. You know,
yes.
That
yes.
team came from the Russell era. And then you grow up in, when I'm in 6th, 7th, 8th grade, when you're in the 80s, Boston is now associated with the Larry Bird era. Yeah. And everybody is looking at the Celtics as a white team. All the brothers around my way, they were 76ers fans.
Sure.
You know, and then later they were Laker fans and then they were Pistons fans. But we were still, I mean, if you're really Black Boston, you supported the Celtics.
Yeah.
Because of what those Black players went through living in Boston.
Yeah.
So, and Russell was always at the center of that.
Yeah.
You know, and the Black community in Roxbury, Mattapan, Dorchester, you know, everybody wanted to protect and support Russell. Everybody, because he owned the restaurant down the road. He owned Slade's. He used to get his hair cut over. I think, you know, all the black players get their hair cut over at Foggy's at the barbershop down there. So this was all personal. And then you come to Oakland. You know, I start my career in Oakland at the old Trib in 91. And what am I doing? I'm covering the Oakland Athletic League. I'm covering preps. And where am I? I'm at Mac. You know, you're at McClyman's all the time because they had a really good basketball team.
Covering me riding a bench at Oakland Tech.
Right? And so I found myself at Mac for basketball and over at Skyline for football because they had John Beam and that team was winning all the time. And I see, did I get eye roll right there?
No, I'm looking at the
time. No, I meant for Marcus. Did I get a Skyline eye roll right there?
I can't eye roll because my wife is a Skyline. But yeah, absolutely, we hated Skyline. We wouldn't schedule Skyline for homecoming. The dumbest thing ever. Like, why are we losing the Skyline for homecoming? 42-0.
Yep. But what I didn't know about Skyline was that Skyline was created to be a white high school.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, and that Tom Hanks and those guys were the first generation of that school, and they tried to redistrict Skyline to keep all the black students out of it.
Right. And that's how, that's why all the feeders, that's why McClyman's had, you go, how did this one school get all these great players? That's why.
That's why. And that's what I said to Monty Poole. I was like, our colleague Monty and Joe, and I wish that Joe were around when I was working on this, and Joe had already passed. I knew he was sick and I tried to call him, but he just wasn't in a position to talk. And then, of course, he passed away. I wanted to ask Joe, how did your family get to move to East Oakland in the 1940s?
Right.
Because he wasn't associated with military or anything like that. I'm like, how did you get out of West Oakland?
Those were all white communities. Brookfield, mm-hmm. Sobrany Park, those were all made for white communities who worked on the war-related industry.
Sure.
Right?
Like, that's right.
Absolutely. I grew up in one of them neighborhoods that it used to be white and then it wasn't.
That's right. And Monty's family, same thing. They grew up in Brookfield Village. What I also found fascinating to your point, DA, about this was, when you start digging into the history of it, everybody's from the same spot. Like Dave Everybody. Stewart was telling me that they used to call Oakland Little New Orleans. Hmm. And that you start looking at the percentage, I think when one of the census things I had seen, it was something like 70, in 1950, 70 to 75% of black Oakland was from Texas and Louisiana.
Right.
Yeah, and nobody's from here.
It's crazy that I'd be very curious to wonder why certain group went to Oakland, went to the Bay Area, and then a certain group went to LA. I just wonder, and they're all from Texas and Louisiana, right? Like migration.
It was the railroads.
There's
the
a railroad.
Stop had two stops in the West. It was supposed to be three. LA and the last stop was West Oakland. It was supposed to go up higher, mm-hmm. but then it stopped. So West Oakland became the spot because you had the port and you had the railroad all mm-hmm. right there. So this was like Black Central. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You Central. Got all these people coming. So LA and Oakland were the two stops on the West with the railroad.
Yeah.
It was so popping. I learned this doing the research from it was so popping. San Francisco got shook and built the bridge.
Right.
It was like,
we need to get over to Oakland.
Yeah, because remember, the gold rush made the San Francisco port the big port.
Yeah.
But when this happened, now the port of Oakland was popping. Like, it was
second
like
biggest
big.
Port in the country.
So they got shook. It was like, hold on, man. We got to get some of this ground traffic coming our way. And they built the Bay Bridge. So if anybody always wonder why Oakland got this beef against San Francisco, like, this has been going on forever. This ain't new, right?
Dude, it's crazy.
What was wild about that, too, was the fact that, to answer your question, DA, then a lot of the businesses, the canneries and the rest of it out in Oakland, they were paying for and housing black people to come.
Mm-hmm.
So they were essentially recruiting.
Right.
And so this was a spot to go. I mean, I just found it fascinating that Bill Russell is from Monroe and so is Huey Newton. And they both lived in Acorn.
Right. Right.
How does that happen?
How
do they go from this little town in Louisiana and move across the country and end up in the same little town?
And end up in the same block.
Right.
Exactly right.
That's crazy. And the prism of races, of course, permeates everything in this country. just look at the third stanza of the national anthem if you don't believe me. it's just ridiculous. But we you have this perspective, Howard, that I wanted to tap into, because being a, and I've talked to guys who lived in Boston, who are from Boston, who grew up in Roxbury, and I get that what you're talking about. And I wonder about, and that's why I think guys like Cedric Maxwell are always kind of like, defensive is not the right word. They think people maybe don't understand the full picture in the history of Boston and Black Boston, right? And,
there is no Black Boston until you ask somebody. People don't know that there's anybody from Boston who's
because,
Black.
Because, you know why, Howard? Because for me, I grew up, being somebody who grew up in Washington, D.C., Boston to me stopped with Ted Landsmark. That was the end of Boston as far as I was concerned. I was done. I'm done with you.
View though, right?
And you know what I'm saying?
Exactly right. And that's why I was saying in the piece, Boston has not recovered from desegregation.
Yeah.
They did not recover from busing because, I mean, people used to make fun of me and I was like, look, I'll be straight up with you. I am a Boston Celtics fan out of protection for all of those Black players.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Parrish was my favorite player. Tiny Archibald, Gerald Henderson, JoJo
Casey
White,
Jones, Sam Jones, Scott, going all the way back, right?
Yes, all of them. And then as the Celtics became a better team, as I said, and you guys are basketball guys, you know this. 1986, the Celtics won the championship in an 80% Black league. 10 of the 14 players on that roster were white.
Yeah.
That cannot be an accident.
Right.
You know how hard it is to do?
Yes, yes.
To do that?
Right.
I mean, and you know, when you looked at the league at that time, you essentially had three teams that everybody knew were the white clubs in the NBA. Boston, Utah, Phoenix. Everybody knew it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how do you trade Rick Roby straight up for Dennis Johnson?
Right.
I mean, how do you make that deal unless you're simply catering? It's the same thing of trading Bill Russell for Ed McCauley and Cliff Hagan, because you are playing
Hugo Green.
Exactly. You're playing to your fan base.
Yeah.
I really do think, Howard, I think especially how you started this piece is the important point that is so lost. And it's very irritating for me, like having in my last book, I was researching the Celtics. I didn't know half this stuff, man. I didn't know what they went through. Yeah. These Black players were so gangster. It morphs any semblance of boldness from the modern athlete.
That's
like,
right.
They faced imminent danger with how they were rocking. And with the conversation becoming so, as you say, like, superficial, right? And mm-hmm. so debate centered. Mm-hmm. Like, why? I feel like we should revere those players in the way baseball reveres Babe Ruth. Where
that's
it's
right.
like, we're going to separate them into this untouchable category. Right. Like, you don't even talk about them out the side of your mouth.
There's no context. Nobody, you know what I'm saying? Nobody says, but Babe Ruth didn't play against any Black players. You know what I mean? Like, nobody says that.
And nobody says, oh, well, Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle and DiMaggio, they didn't have to, you know, play a division series or an ALCS. They just say those guys were winners.
Yeah.
But yet we always try to find some way to denigrate that golden age.
Yeah.
And those guys went through what they went through. And one of the things that they went through the most that we never talk about was just simple equipment. You look at these guys playing in low top chucks.
Right. somebody put on Twitter a picture of the shoe that Bill Russell played.
They didn't even have
air conditioning. It's insane. Like you played games in those shoes. That's ridiculous. Yeah, like that's crazy.
Let's go play a doubleheader in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Right, and play three games and three nights in three cities. Try that flying commercial. Try that sometime in 1958.
I remember looking at, I think it was the Warriors. I think in 75 when the Warriors played Phoenix, I think it was in the playoffs. Not exactly sure on that. But I was looking at those day by days and they played home, and home.
Yeah.
Right? They didn't even play two and then go. They were playing home game travel.
Right.
That's a lot of travel.
I never considered myself a leader. My ambition was to try to conduct myself in a fashion that my father could be proud of. I remember the proudest day I had. We played one-on-one and I got his respect. That was the most of my important day in basketball. My father always emphasized to me and my brother nobody can help you unless you help yourself first. Self-help. That was the kind of the philosophy.
I was covering the Bullets, and to see, you know, there were four seats in first class, and it was the head coach and the trainer and the assistant coach and maybe the most senior player. The rest of the players were in coach with me. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see Charles Jones, 6'9", in a coach seat.
In a little coach seat.
You know what I mean? Like on U.S. Air to Pittsburgh to Phoenix or wherever. It's just, this is crazy.
He was happy it wasn't a bus.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? So...
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23. For a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
But I want to talk more about Russell. And again, the thing that you wrote about so brilliantly, Howard, and you both wrote about it brilliantly, but the notion of anger. And the perception of anger, and what always annoyed me about the perception of Bill Russell was that he was somehow this angry black man.
Mm-hmm.
He was angry when it was warranted, but most of the time he was just spouting facts.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Like, funny. I mean, you know what I find fascinating about that too, when it comes to Russell, is that you have all these people saying that he was sour, bitter, angry, and yet. They always talk about his laugh.
Yes.
How on earth can somebody so sour laugh that much that everybody knows his laugh? Right. Clearly, you're not spending enough time understanding who he is and where he's from and what made him.
And you say the exact same thing about Oscar Robertson.
That's
he's
right.
He's bitter. No, he's not. He's just saying
not bitter.
He's just saying the triple double wasn't a big deal because there wasn't a stat for it when he was playing.
That's right.
He just did it.
You know? Let me ask you guys a question, because this is a very Russell-centric question. What do you do when someone doesn't accept your apology? Like, how are we left with that? Because the story of black and white America has always been one of reconciliation. Somewhere along the line, we're supposed to accept your apology.
Yeah.
We're expected to, you know, things are better than they were.
Move on.
Things are better than they used to be. Right, let's move on, you know. Yeah. Or isn't this progress? And that's one of the reasons why I always say, you know, I don't want to hear about the first black whatever. There's only one time I want to hear about the first black whatever. And that is if you honestly believe that this black person is the most unique and remarkable black person who could do something that no other black person in the history of black people could do. Otherwise, what we're really talking about is you.
Well, that's John Thompson used to always say he was insulted by the question because the question assumed that he was the first one qualified to do it.
He actually could do it. So my thing when it comes to Russell is Bill Russell recognized early on, I'm not going to engage in this type of arena, right? Yeah. That I'm not going to be the one who's allowing you to reconcile with me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be me and I'm going to leave it to you to figure out why you are the way you are. Because really, it's what I tell my son all the time. All this stuff happening in the world, we all talk about how polarizing and how divided we are. I said, no, this is just white people talking to other white people. Because our needs haven't changed. Our desires haven't changed. The things that we're asking for haven't changed. And if you're Bill Russell, I think when you're reading Gary Pomerantz's book, The Last Pass, which is a terrific book, and you go back and you look at these different moments with Russell, like when I used to talk to Tommy Heinsohn about this all the time, essentially, what they were saying was Bill Russell didn't take, you know, he didn't accept our apology, you know, that he was not willing to play along and say, it's okay, things are better than they were. He was like, no, you need to figure yourselves out. I mean, I'm fine. You need to figure yourselves out.
Athlete's responsibility, assess what do I have and how can I use that to make the world a better place for everybody. My responsibility to you and your response for me is the same. I will respect your humanity and you respect mine. One of the reasons we found Mentor, the idea is to, who can you bring with you?
I was raised under that. Like, that's essentially the spirit of Oakland, right? We saw him do that. It's like, hey. And then you got Huey Newton, right? It's like, we got the Black Panthers, right? Like, right. You can apologize all you want to. Ain't nobody think about that.
That's why
I think, I don't think we understand how gangster that was to do there.
Exactly, right.
Like, that's, right. Right. That to me is imminent danger.
That, it's
right.
Exactly,
you talk about
it
guys like I always wonder, like, what was it like for Tommy Heinsohn? He was the one white guy starting with four black dudes, right?
Like,
he had to be a gangster too. You know what I'm saying?
Like,
he
got rookie of the year,
right,
over Bill Russell.
Yeah, yeah.
And Russ let him know that should have been my award. Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing, right? Like, when I say, what do you do when someone doesn't accept your apology? What I'm saying is that look at what happens when you come to somebody white and you're not grateful. And that's how they saw Russell. They saw Russell as somebody who wasn't grateful. It's like, look, can't you see we're trying to do better? We're allowing you to play in this league and we're telling you how great you are and we're trying to make this right. And you're not giving us our grace for trying to make it right. Mm-hmm. And you see how angry people get when you're not willing to be conciliatory with them, you know? And that's really where it's like, oh, and that, well, you know, he's uppity and he's, you know, he's angry and all that. It's not his problem. It's your problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the expectation is, and I get this, whether you're in a relationship, you know, like, what's the worst thing to say when your girl gets mad at you, right? And you say, I'm sorry. And her response is, you should be.
I'm trying to apologize
to you, right? I mean, if you're Bill Russell, like I'm reading the story of Cousy after all these years.
Right.
Cousy's trying to say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And Russell's like, that moment has passed.
Exactly. Exactly.
He's not wrong.
Right. Right. You can't fix what happened in 1961. You know what I mean? Like, what you say now, that's why I always say, what did they do then when it mattered? What did they then? Not now.
What is so cool about this that will never get old? Never get old. Is that he was always all right.
That's right.
Yes, like fine.
Like he was always all right. He's still, I'm going to kick it. I'm going to live a life that's full. Like you say, I'm going to keep smiling. Like he was always all right. To me, that is so good. Like if you read like Second Wind, man, it's just riffing, bro. Like he just said, whatever you want to say. Like,
that's right.
In those times, that was insane.
I mean, and the hard part of this too, from a basketball standpoint, And especially, you know, Marcus, you know this because, you know, you're dealing with two of the greatest players that ever played the game right now. And everybody kept saying early on, who's the number one? Who's a one? Oh, yeah. Who's a two, right? Whose team is it? You know, D.A., you know, whose team is it?
Yeah.
What do you do if you're Bob Cousy in 1957, and you are the center of the league? You're the face of the league. You are the league. You've never even been to a final. Never mind win a championship. You've never been to the finals. And then this guy comes along, and you have to acknowledge he's the difference maker. Mm-hmm. Just from not even a racial standpoint, just from a competitive standpoint, what do you do when you realize this guy's the real deal?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How does that shake you psychically? You know what I mean? Like, how does that, you know, how do you accept that? And again, I don't think he did in that time, right? Like
he never accepted it.
Right. You
know? So, and then on top of that,
he wasn't encouraged to accept it either by the
fan
base.
Right. No. And then
but I don't accept your tears now. You know what I mean?
How do you accept the other piece of this, which is everybody also knows that you're getting the dispensation, you're getting the free dinners, you're getting the ski trips, you're getting all this when the other guy's better.
Yeah.
The other guy's the reason why you're winning these championships. And you know that you have to defer to him, but your whiteness keeps you in front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. when you're mm-hmm. Bob Cousy, you kind of know who the better player is right
now. Sure.
And your coach lets
him read the paper at practice.
Your coach did not draft you when it was time to draft you.
Right.
And later acquired you in other means. But coach knew. Woo.
No question.
It's 100%. And so, you know, when you're dealing with somebody like Russell, you're dealing with such a towering figure. And to the point, what I was trying to get at in the first part of the story was all this ranking stuff that we do now, it doesn't even apply to him. Like there's no real measure when you're bringing someone like Bill Russell into the mix. Right. It just doesn't work on any level.
Right. No, it doesn't. And as I always say to people who use all of the arguments you hear these days, if it was easy, somebody else would have won 11 rings in 13 years.
That's right. That's right. I mean,
nobody else did. Also,
11 rings ain't enough, though. Like, that's to say he won 11 rings ain't enough because you got to say when he won those 11, right?
Yeah.
That's a different time. Like, a win in a championship, then, like, if you talk about the degree of difficulty, if you could add somehow an inflation figure of pressure, it would rise then. It wouldn't shrink.
Yeah, right.
It would rise back then.
Wait, right. What is the equivalent? What is the metric of an 8-team NBA in 2022? The concentration of talent,
dude,
on those rosters.
This is part of what drives me crazy. He played Wilt every week. He didn't play him twice a year.
Exactly.
He played him every week. What are you talking about?
Also, like now the worst thing that could happen to you is people troll you on social. Like the worst thing that happened to you back then was life got rough. Right? Like you couldn't check out. You couldn't go to some, you know, exorbitant place where you can surround yourself.
For a few days.
No. Like the pressure of winning, right? Like, remember, Sam wasn't even gonna go there, right? He was like, "Yo, I'm gonna be a teacher."
Right.
He got drafted by the Celtics and was like, "I'm never gonna play for them." Yeah. Right? Like, I'm gonna be riding a bitch. The amount of pressure to win. If you're a black team and you playing in Boston and you don't win,
right?
Like, we barely accepted you now. If that's you 100%. Don't win, like, you got it. So to me, them 11 championships, that's a different level, especially 7, 8, 9, where it's like, yo, you better win. Like, that to me, that we undervalue.
Yeah.
The value of those, right? It's just like, oh, he won 11 titles. Like, nah, you thought it was tough now.
Right.
It's like the great players, black or white, it doesn't make any difference. They never take anything for granted. Obama entered into a field and went all the way to the top and never lost his real humanity. And that's what happens to a lot of people that are successful.
Steve Kerr, and I'm sure he's told you this too, Marcus, he says, after the Bulls won 3 and after the Warriors, there ain't no way we're going to win no 6 in a They're row. Done. Are you nuts?
Done.
Yeah.
We're done. Yeah. We were done.
I always say that it is harder today than ever to be a champion.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because by today's measures, you get treated like a legend, you get compensated like a legend, you get the visibility of a legend without being a legend.
Before doing anything or legendary.
Doing anything even close. Yeah. Those dudes, they had to win legends. To get money.
Yeah.
They were literally prize fighters. They had to go out there. If you didn't win, you didn't get paid.
Right. Right.
It's, you know?
It is a damnable lie and mistreatment of the era that our parents grew up in. You know, I say this all the time. I have no idea. The scope of my father's life is so much more significant than anything that I will do in the course of my life. For a man who grew up, who was born in Tampa, Florida, with no running water, and it was a step up to go to the projects.
That's right.
That was a step up.
Well, and that's what people don't realize. Yeah. That's what people don't realize either, is that when the housing projects were first built in the 1950s, everybody wanted to go there.
Right. Right.
They had elevators.
Right. Yeah. And bathrooms.
Exactly. Nobody was like, damn, why are these windows so small? People actually wanted to live there.
You know what I mean?
And some people did not get to, right? Imagine that.
That's
people.
Right.
Like, I didn't even get in.
Well, that's right. Well, Nicholas Lehman's book, The Promised Land, talks about that, about the projects in Chicago. It's a really terrific book because it talks about the lack of screening and how the projects turned into the projects, right? They used to be a desirable place, and then the government just stopped screening and stuff just went sideways.
Down. Yeah. So I always get angry when people denigrate anybody, but certainly the accomplishments of black men and black women in the 1940s and 50s.
No doubt.
Chris Rock says, had to deal with real racism. You know what I'm saying? Like,
that's true. And you know I think, too, when it comes to someone like Russell, what we're all trying to do, to your point, D.A., earlier about not having the words, none of us have the words. What we're trying to do is to at least, and in some ways, you know, your writing is mourning. You're just thinking out loud. You're just trying to say something to put this in the sort of context to give the man a thank you, you know, to sort of say something along those lines, that place. And also to sort of check ourselves that everything is supposed to be better now. Well, maybe not. Maybe our discourse also needs a little checking as well. And I think that when I think about Russell, and I think about the Boston piece of the story, I love the fact that Bomani sort of put out, you know, that Marcus hit the Oakland story.
Yeah,
it just came in my inbox. So damn, I'm going to read it when I get out. But you know, from a Boston standpoint, it was just really important to me to sort of at least let people remember that the Celtics belong to black people. I know that that narrative has been shifted and changed and twisted and distorted because of what's happened in the past, but this is also what happens when you allow white people and the white American mainstream to dictate everything. And they don't get to dictate everything. If you're black from Boston in the 1960s, in the 1970s, that team belonged to you.
Yeah.
And that should not be forgotten.
Right. Sam Jones was the clutch one.
Sam Jones. Right. Sam Jones was a scorer. He and Heinsohn were the scorers on that team.
That's right. That's right. And JoJo White. Put some respect on his name. You know what I mean? Like, I get you. I got you. And it came full circle to me, Howard. When I covered the Celtics in 08 when they won, and I really felt like KG's presence was enormous in terms of
KG's the.
You know what I mean?
He's the heir.
They right? Have, you know, that's what I was that's heir. What I was thinking at the time was he seems to make it okay for younger black people to root for the Celtics. is the vibe I got from watching being in Boston during that whole playoffs. I saw so many young black people in their 20s and 30s rocking jerseys, and I was like, okay. He said it's okay.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's okay again, right?
So. You got to do your trivia question. Now, KG got traded and Ray Allen got traded, but who's the greatest black player to join the Celtics voluntarily? Unrestricted free agent, that's my destination. Who's the best player to choose to do that? It's Kyrie got traded. Now, he okayed the trade. KD might okay a trade to Boston. Ray Allen and those guys okayed the trade to Boston. But it was still a trade.
Right. No, but by choice. Who's by free choice. Agent? Yes. It's a great question. That is a great question.
It doesn't happen. So, and the reason for that goes back to Ted Landsmark and that famous photo of somebody, of a man trying to stab a lawyer with an American flag in Government Center.
Right, right. It's just
so wild. By the way, Kevin Garnett, South Carolina native who migrated to Chicago for
Chicago,
high school.
Yes, same story. Over and over again, right? Same story. Yes,
same
absolutely.
Story. Right?
Absolutely.
The answer, I believe, is probably Kemba Walker or Al Horford.
Al Horford's a good call. That might be Al Horford. Yes. Could
but
be
it was
Horford.
Like 37-year-old Al Horford, but
no, but the first time before the first time, so that was 2016. He went there the first time.
Yeah, what is he 30, went there voluntarily. 32? Yeah.
All right. Let's get you out on this. Give us one great rookie story that's in your book.
Narrow it down. Let's see how you
narrow it down.
There's only 700 of them in the book. I know.
I would still say my favorite rookie story is probably a toss-up between 15-year-old Ricky at Oakland Tech and being put on the JV because the new baseball coach didn't know anything about him, and he just pointed at the different kids, and Ricky looked like one of the smaller kids, and he said, you to the JV. And that Ricky looks at a grown man and says, you must not know who I am. That is so Oakland.
That's so, man.
Right? That's a 15-year-old to look at a grown-up and say, you must not know who I am.
That is so good.
Ricky hit him with the you must not know about me way before Beyonce.
Exactly. You must have forgot. Who does that? As a 10th grader.
That is so awesome.
Oh my God. I mean, it's that, or it is last but not least, after he's with the Blue Jays and they win the championship, the next year he joins the A's and they go to play the Blue Jays. And when you drive into Sky Dome, there was a big billboard that had no words on it. It just had a picture of Joe Carter and then the time.
Jumping in the air, right?
Jumping
right.
in the air. Joe Carter hitting the home run. Yes. And so this starts a debate on the A's team bus about where was everybody during the Joe Carter home run. And everybody's going back and forth and talking about where they were. And Dave Feldman, the great statistician with KRON, is talking about how he was on his couch in San Francisco watching the game. And then there are other people going, chiming in about where they were. And suddenly, in the back of the bus, you hear this voice, I was on second base.
Just so you know.
Just so you know. Hey, that's a mic drop of mic drops.
Oh,
I was on second base.
I did my job. Oh my God, Howard, man, this has been phenomenal.
There you go.
God almighty. God,
you know, And I would say, you know what, and CUDA on TNT and everything. I was like, I would like to do that, but I can't.
Oh, I know. We all fill in the picture in different places. I know.
There you go. And Marcus, man, so
y'all
proud of you.
Y'all played y'all roles for me. Come on. Both of y'all set it up for me.
That's... No, all I was saying is that I was really, really nervous, and I'll let y'all go. I know you got to go. You got to go to the funeral down at the yard.
I told somebody yesterday, this is like sit and shiver. You know what I mean?
I was really concerned about this book the same way I was concerned about the Hank Aaron book, because it's not my area. You know, with the Hank Aaron book, I was like, I got three problems. One, I was born in 1968. Henry was born in 1934. You can't be putting your 1968 on his 1934.
Right.
Here's what I would have done back then.
Right, right, right.
You can't do that, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Right.
You know, second issue, I'm born in Boston. He's born in Mobile. So you can't, you know, you really can't bring your Boston down to the South because they're not going to trust you. And of course, the third thing is that, you know, Henry retired when I was 7 years old. I have no institutional memory. I have no physical memory of watching him play. Yeah. The same was true in Oakland. Now, I started my career out there, and I saw Ricky play and the whole thing, but Oakland is a very special, very unique place, and they know a phony when they see one. No, right. You have to be able to sort of bring it. I tell you this story because I was talking to a couple of dudes, and I remember talking to, I think it was Bip and Shooty Babbitt, and I was like, okay, somebody from Oakland should be doing this book. And my boy Chris, who's one of my best friends, who's from Oakland as well, he works over at Goldman Sachs, and he was like, you know, you're right. You know, and if you don't do it, Marcus Thompson is the only other guy who could do it. So just everybody's watching you as well, and they love your work. And so I was like, you know, I better make sure I get this right.
You did, my brother.
Yes, you did. I wouldn't pick anybody else. As soon as I remember you called me about it, I was hype. What? Yo, hype. Let's go.
It's that look that we all give the brother across the street when you just go.
Yeah.
Good.
That's what I want. I just want to get old enough to where I don't have to say hi no more. I just point.
No, just give him the.
You know what I'm saying? Nah.
You know.
Only thing I might say is, all right now.
All right now. Well, the other thing I always say too with Mark's, like, one of the things that one of the professors, Lou Moore over at Grand Valley State, was telling me was that whenever I go into a bookstore, I go into the sports section and I go and look and see how many black authors are writing on black subjects.
It
always pleases me when I notice that your stuff book is right next to mine. I love that. Yeah. Like that we're awesome. In there and you're,
right.
You know, alphabetically it doesn't quite work, but, you know, but I love the
it's
fact
lot,
that
it's a lot between us, huh?
Right. But I do love, I just love the fact that when I walk into a bookstore, I usually somewhere along the line, I see one of your books and I love seeing that.
That's fantastic. Fantastic.
I appreciate it. Thanks for passing it down, baby.
The best of luck to you with everything, man, with the book, with the writing, everything, man. It's always, I always stop what I'm doing when I see you drop something.
Well, come hit me up. I'll see you up. I'll
also,
be in your
you
town Friday night.
Town, by the way.
You coming here Friday?
Town,
coming
so, to let's go eat somewhere.
I will find you. I'll be in town for five days working on the next book.
There you go.
And you adopted on DC Oakland book? There, by the way. Shit. I don't want to hear that mess.
No,
you
my man coming in, going right about some DC stuff. Now, this angers me now.
I am not doing a DC. I am not doing a DC book. I am doing...
you're doing another book. It's okay.
On Jackie Robinson testifying against Paul Robeson in front of...
Oh, that's right. I saw that.
In front of HUAC. So I'll be at the Library of Congress.
How about that?
Researching Jackie and Paul Robeson.
That is so great.
That's going to be great.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Oh yeah. God. All right, so let's go do your thing. Thank you for having me.
Safe travels, man.
You got it.
Man, y'all better leave a 5-star review on this on Apple, on Spotify, Google Play, every place you get this fine American podcast. Marcus, if them heifers can't leave 5 stars, what do they need to do?
Keep it to yourself, you haters.
Oakland haters, Boston haters.
Exactly. Hey, and Marcus, haters? Don't forget, man, September 11th, I believe, we'll be in the Bay because Dave Stewart is getting his number retired.
Yep, oh, absolutely.
Oh,
I'm in the building. Now, Stu, you know what I'm saying? Stu, like, come on, man, that's my era right here. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. Yeah.
All right, yeah, we out.
I realized what my high school coach did. He was a white guy, coaching an all-black team. My high school coach said, "These are my kids." When I try to help kids, I don't say, "Can I help the black kids?" If there's a white kid there that needs help, they put them in the same category. And I hope is the ambition of this country is that we work on our common humanity, create opportunities for kids that don't have enough help growing up. There's no such thing as other people's kids. That's the next generation of America.